we are thankful and grateful for your love for us. We marvel that you would take delight in us. We are thankful, even as we think of your word that says, "What is man that you are mindful of him?" And yet we are because you have made us. Lord, we pray as we gather to study, to hear you speak to us in your word, and to just give you praise and glory. We ask that you would be with us this day. In Christ's name, amen. All right, so I thought I would, I was trying to decide what on earth am I going to do today. And I thought I'd just tackle an easy subject. The Christian and the environment. We all remember this, right, from the 70s? It was ubiquitous. It was everywhere. I don't know that it was a call to action for me, but it certainly was impressionable. These were the days when I was thinking about this. These were the days when, even today it strikes me as odd when I hear somebody say they're going up to Lake Erie to go swimming and boating, because you couldn't do that. These were the days of Love Canal, and just, you know, Lake Erie was just a cesspool of everything. So, I think we've made significant progress. We'll talk a little bit about sort of how we respond, and I'm going to leave some time at the end to sort of talk through how do we engage in some of the silliness that's going on related to environment. But I want us to sort of look at what are our obligations regarding the environment. So God has clearly placed human beings in positions of authority or responsibility over the creation. This is ringing just a little bit. Connor, this is ringing just a little bit. Thank you. Is that better? Yes, that's better. Genesis 2:15 says, where is that? There we go. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. And those two words are important, work and keep. They can be translated, work and keep can be translated serve and preserve. So there's an aspect in which, because sometimes I think we have a view of work that is utilitarian, right? Why do we work? To eat. and there is that aspect of it. But there's more than that. And I think we get that, particularly those of you who are fond of gardening. I am not one of those guys. But those of you who are fond of gardening, I think you understand that there's a sense in which it's more than just having a vegetable garden in order to eat. But there's beauty. There's something about redeeming, even if it's just a small plot of land, and fighting back against the curse of the fall with weeds. And I got home, pulled into my driveway yesterday, and I was so excited. I've been asking Mario, who's one of the many lawn guys. He cuts the golf course area behind my house that I have to pay to have cut. That's another story for another day. But anyway, so I asked him about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, "Mario, I need my palm trees trimmed. I'll get to you." Every time I see him, "I'm behind. I'll get to you." So he was at the neighbor's house last week before we left, and he said, "I will get to you this week," and then he didn't come. So when I pulled in my driveway, all my palm trees are trimmed. So yay. There is a sense in which we understand that serving and preserving. We recognize that all created things belong to God. God made them, therefore they're his. And we are accountable to him as stewards of the creation. We have an obligation. He put us on the earth to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and to subdue the creation. That is, not to rule over it necessarily, but to steward it, to tend it, to care for it. because it's His, it's not ours. That we're going to talk about that this morning in our passage in 1 Timothy, in terms of what is the church, because too often we are too possessive of the church and it doesn't belong to us. It does not belong to us. It belongs to God, and we'll talk more about that. Same way with creation. Sin mars this, obviously, but we should, as followers of Christ, we should have an understanding of contentment that the world certainly can't have, because we understand that nothing is mine. It's all His, and He graciously gives it to us. So God commissions us to rule over the creation in a way that sustains, protects, and enhances His works so that all creation may fulfill the purposes God intended for it. We need to manage the environment not simply for our own benefit, but for God's glory. And we'll unpack that a little bit more. Now, some might argue that humans are more important than the rest of creation. And you can make a strong argument biblically that the pinnacle of creation, at least, was mankind and God's creation of man. But because man is most important, then we should focus our efforts on meeting the needs of people rather than addressing environmental issues. However, many of our environmental problems negatively impact people. If we fail to care for the environment in which we live, God's people will suffer as a result. Caring for the non-human parts of the creation and preserving the intricate interactions among them is an important part of doing God's work, not only for God's people, but for humanity as well. Others would argue that protecting the environment is unimportant in comparison to other God-given tasks like sharing the gospel. I'll have a lot more to say about that in a minute. But God is concerned with the physical world as well as the spiritual world. When we put too much emphasis on the spiritual, we become Platonists, dualists, that says spirit good, physical ultimately is bad, okay? And God made material things. And not only did He make material things, but at the end of making all material things, He said it is very good. Okay, so material things are good in and of themselves because God has made them. God is concerned with the physical world as well as the spiritual world, and restoration of the creation is part of the good news of Christ. Part of the reason Christ came was not only to redeem a people for Himself, but to redeem creation. And we'll see that in a moment. We're not to neglect the task of sharing the good news of Christ's redeeming work. That is our highest priority. But neither should we neglect the work of tending the garden, if you will. Caring for God's creation is part of our service to God and an integral part of our role as servant leaders in God's kingdom. As we serve God in the world, we do it by sharing the gospel, by living Christ-like before the world, and part of that means tending the garden that He has put us into. There are numerous things that we can do in our everyday lives that can help protect God's creation. I was trying to think what are two. I think two of the biggest things are conserving energy and reducing waste. These don't interfere with our witness to unbelievers. If I worry about reducing energy or reducing waste, I think, in fact, they enhance our witness to others as they see our faith in action. What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? It doesn't mean that we remove ourselves from the world. Jesus never said, don't be in the world. He said, be in the world, but don't be of the world, right? So part of being in the world but not of the world is to actually help people to understand what does it mean for a follower of Christ to live in this world that God has made. I got lost again. Our concern for the environment could open opportunities to share with unbelievers that our service to creation overflows out of our love for God. That it becomes a part of our witness. Putting this together, there are a number of mainline churches that have intricate statements on environment, none of which we would agree with. There's almost a sense in which they assign deity to material things. And we have to be very careful in that regard. We worship God, the Creator, more fully as we see His glory in His creation and as we participate in His work of sustaining and restoring proper relationships within creation. God gave all of the animals of the land and the sea and the air for our benefit. And that's more than just providing food. It means that we have a balance. There's a balance with those things that we have to maintain. And we haven't always done that very well. We are pretty good at causing species to become extinct because of the way that we treat them. Okay? All right. Some scriptural references. This will sort of lay the foundation for the rest of us, the rest of our time together. So Genesis 1, 25 to 28, and God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Psalm 8, when I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? And the Son of Man that you care for him. Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the sea. Psalm 24. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein, for he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. This is an interesting case law in Leviticus 25. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land. Land ownership is rather important to us as Americans. And what we need to understand is what that means, right? And so, in a sense, as followers of Christ, we hold it in trust because it's not ours. It's given to us to care for and to tend. I think of some of the just practical guidance in the scriptures of every time we go through the living with the land in Epcot. I don't know if any of you have been through that ride. They talk about how in certain places they're talking about how innovative this idea is, that they don't plant every year. They actually turn the soil over and let it rest. Like, duh, God told us that thousands and thousands of years ago. There are cycles, and we have abused land, and we've learned how to manipulate that abuse with fertilizers, with genetically modified seeds, etc., etc. We have overfished the seas to the point where there are some places that have hardly any fish anymore, and we thankfully, I think, even like with fish, we're learning how to farm fish which I think is a great way of being good stewards over the things God has given us. All right, Romans 8. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. So it's, again, well, the next one sort of spells out what that means. Colossians 1. For in him, in Christ, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. So Jesus' death not only accomplished the salvation of his people, but it accomplished the ultimate restoration of God's good creation that we'll get to live in forever, which was the intent at the beginning. All right. So the question then that I think is most pertinent is this. So what? So what? Is there room in Reformed theology, because I think sometimes we struggle with this one, is there room in Reformed theology for creation care, stewardship of resources, and pollution cleanup? Yes, it is absolutely there is room for that. Reformed theology is a vision of God's sovereignty over the universe that he has made. He has an eternal purpose for it, and he is not going to throw it away in the trash heap. Some people think he is, but he's not. 2 Peter 3 talks about the universe being burned up. I don't think Peter means there to junk the universe and start over with a new one. I don't think that's at all what he is intending. I think rather what he is intending for us to understand is to be cleansed like a forest fire. This is one of those, I don't know, in the last several years particularly, it seems like we've been inundated with stories about forest fires. They aren't new. They're not new. And contrary to much of the rhetoric of today, they aren't even as numerous or extensive as they have been in the past. There have been times when it has been greater. The problem is we like to live in places that burn. That's the problem. Just like we like to live in places that are battered by hurricanes, right? Because those are places that we're attracted to. So the problem is not forest fires. The answer is not to stop forest fires. That can't be, because that's part of the cleansing process that California is a great example of this. About 10 years ago, they instituted a new policy that said that that we're going to leave our forests natural, right? It was a very bad decision, because what it did was it allowed all sorts of tinder in those forests, and woof, places that don't have those laws, who have similar sort of environmental constructs, don't see the same level of fires. And I think that's part of it. I remember my dad had about 8 acres when I was growing up, and once he retired, he spent Monday through Saturday working in those 8 acres. And most of it was wooded, and he made sure he got all of the stuff out from underneath, because he knew even there, if you got a brush fire, it would be devastating. It's just good stewardship to do that. So I'm encouraged when I hear some environmental scientists say, make sure that you keep the areas around your house free from debris and those kinds of things. I mean, it's just common sense. All right, how did I get down that road? The nice thing, if a forest fire comes through, it takes decades for it to come back. God can do in a moment what it takes creation to do over a long period of time. So the universe that we live in is God's. He made it, and he made it good. It's a mess right now. I don't know if you've noticed that. It's a mess both in sin and in catastrophe. And it isn't always going to be this way. It's going to be renewed someday. We're living in a planet, in a universe that is going to always be here. And God will renew it one day. So it matters to him that we care for it. I love this phrase in the Gloria Patri when we sing it. World without end. I remember hearing a dispensationalist one time. I think it was Jack Van Impe. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Jack Van Impe. Oh, yeah. I remember him, he was talking about how God is just going to destroy everything and make a new creation. And then he stumbled across the Gloria Patri. And it made him rethink what the Bible actually teaches about it. He didn't abandon his dispensationalism, but he did understand and recognize that God is not going to destroy the earth. He's going to cleanse the earth and remake it. And it was because of this idea of world without end. So that's one argument. The more important argument, I think, and these aren't exclusive to Reformed theology. This is just good Bible theology, is loving our neighbor as we love ourselves. That's the better argument for why we should care for the creation. I don't think that the argument from the fact that this earth is going to be renovated someday is the best argument to make for having clean water. I don't think that's a good argument at all. And if anything, I've heard it said that since God is going to burn up this world, we shouldn't be bothered. Load the landfills and joy without consequence. And that's how we live our lives, by the way. That's how we live our lives. I even had someone tell me that they never recycle because God will do that in the end. Very seriously said that to me. All I can say is no, no, no. You care about clean water because you love your neighbor and your grandkids and people in general, and you want to reduce suffering. Piper talks about the commitment at Bethlehem Baptist Church to physical, social, and spiritual things this way. He says, I want us to care a lot about and work toward eliminating suffering, especially eternal suffering. That's the order. Right? So I have an obligation to care for my neighbor, not just in making sure that they hear the gospel so that they can have eternal life, but also to relieve their suffering. Also that they can enjoy this creation that God has made. God made this creation and even allows those who will spend eternity in hell to enjoy creation here. Okay? That's why we live here, by the way. Right? Because this is a beautiful slice of God's creation. It is. I posted a picture, I don't know. Oh, I was giving a friend a hard time online. I had posted a picture of somewhere we were this week. And I said, you need to take your wife on a warm vacation. They live in Pennsylvania. It's been cold and snowy. And one of my friends said, why are you going on a warm vacation? You live in Florida. Anyway. So we're to relieve suffering. Suffering like you drink this water and you get dysentery and you die suffering. We have an obligation to help in those ways. Okay? I want to... If we can, we need to fix it. I love mission trips, but they are often not helpful. They are often not helpful because what we do is we go and we do what people ought to be doing for themselves. But they may not have the capability or the training. So what we ought to be doing is going and showing them, teaching them how to do those things. right? Don't go and build a building and dig a well. Go and show them how that, or provide the materials for that, right? But we don't always do that very well. Clean water is the number one cause, is the number one reason why, a lack of clean water is the number one reason why most people die in the world. Because they don't have clean water. And we just take it for granted. I mean, we absolutely take it for granted. In fact, we'd lose our minds if the power goes out and I don't have water from the well, if I have a well, right? If you release garbage from your city and it all goes into the river downstream, all the fish die and the ecological thing gets out of joint. So put a filter upstream. I mean, there are things in which we can do. Living where we live. We have problems with excess fertilizer in our water. Lake Okeechobee is not the pristine place that it probably once was. That has an effect here. As the water comes into the Peace River and down into the Charlotte Harbor, and we have things in the water that we shouldn't have. And so we need to think about how to mitigate those things. So I think the best argument for environmental concern is love for people, not love for Mother Earth. Who cares about Mother Earth as a mother? Well, the Earth is not our mother, right? We are not pantheists. Maybe some of us do. I don't know that this crowd would. I'm not a big fan of yoga. Not because the exercises aren't good and all of that, but it's what's connected to yoga that most people don't think about. When you go to a yoga, and I've never been, but I have watched them, if you go to a yoga session, the first thing that they're going to teach you is what it means, what namaste means. And that means to sort of empty yourself of you and plant yourself into the earth and allow that energy to become part of you. That's the very beginning of yoga. Or Wendy and I went to Sedona one time. They have what are they called? The vortices, and they're supposed to provide spiritual energy from the earth, right? The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. I don't care for the environment because the earth is my mother. I care for the environment because it belongs to God and I have an obligation to tend it because it's His. It's His and it is meant to serve people. He put us here to enjoy it. I mean, you think about the order of creation. God takes chaos, brings order to chaos, provides light, dark, land, water, plants, animals, and then at the end of all of that, what does He do? He makes man and puts him in that place, right? So God intends for us to enjoy it. And He intended for work to be wonderful. We're going to work in heaven when heaven comes to earth. We're going to work, but it will not be like work today, where we work by the sweat of our brow now because of the fall. We are meant to enjoy this creation. So if we mess it up, we're hurting people. I remember one of my dear friends, although we have sort of drifted apart because he's become a liberal. His name is Pete Enns. You may run into him from time to time if you ever see any progressive Christianity stuff. He's one of the poster boys for that now. But I remember this would have been about 1985. I used to go to their house about once a week for dinner, and one day I got there. Pete was changing the oil in his car, And Pete took the pan of dirty oil, walked down to the culvert, and dumped it in the culvert. And I was horrified. But it let it become somebody else's problem, right? Because what we do, we're so individually minded that we fail to recognize there are 7 billion people that live on this planet. You probably don't think about things like I do. Maybe you do. I'm pumping gas, and I try to make sure that I don't have any gas drip off the end when I'm done. Because in my brain, I realize I drop 3 drops of gas on the ground. You multiply that times millions and millions and millions and millions, and that's a lot of gas. It's a lot of gas. So we do our part to care and tend. All right. So those two things, the earth is going to be here forever and God cares about it. And second, loving people means that you should care about the environment, about how the environment hurts them, are why I think Reformed theology teaches us to care about the environment. Now, I want to save the last 10 minutes to sort of talk through, and maybe you have some questions. But we live in a time now where we're being inundated by environmental concerns. It seems as if that is the driving factor in almost everything that we do. We just had a huge infrastructure bill that is very much geared towards a certain perspective on protecting the environment. And there's a part of me that says, okay, yay, that's a good thing. It's a good thing that we want to preserve and protect the environment. The problem and the challenge is when you arrive at a view that is completely detached from God, it takes on a different meaning and purpose. Is the earth warming up? Yes. That's irrefutable, right? If anybody says it's not warming up, they're not telling the truth. It is warming up. The question that we ought to be asking that we don't have answers for is why? Why is it warming up? We don't know the answer. We simply inflate our use of fossil fuels as the cause. We don't know that that's the cause. I was thinking about this. I remember as a kid seeing pictures of George Washington at Valley Forge. What are all the pictures? What do they show? Lots of snow, bitter cold. They had to dodge ice on the Delaware River to cross into New Jersey. I don't know if you've been to Philadelphia in December, but that's not what the weather is typically. But the reason it was then is because we were the North American, and really the whole Northern Hemisphere, was in what was understood to be a mini ice age. It was just cold, and it was cold extensively. And there was no one can put a finger on and say, this is why, right? It might have to do with solar flares and solar activity. We don't know those things. And it may be that the earth, that the sun is going through a cycle and it's causing the earth to warm. Right? The only way, and here's the real challenge for all of that. We probably won't know the answers to why we're warming up now for another 100 or 200 years. That's the challenge. So the other side of that is when I was in fifth grade, so that would have been 1972, oil embargo is on the horizon. Everybody's wondering what's going to go on. And I remember in 30 years, we will be out of oil. Okay, that was 50 years ago. And we actually have more oil today and more reserve today than we did in 1972. That's not to say that oil is necessarily inexhaustible, all right? That's not what I'm saying. Of course, I lived in a coal mining community, so the alternative was we should move away from oil and gas and move towards coal. Because we have 300 or 400 years of coal left. And I don't know how much coal we have. I have no idea. We have a lot of coal. But when you start moving away from it, well, when you start having policies that want to move you away from fossil fuels, there's a problem with that. What's the problem? Where I grew up, a lot of the farmers are trying to, they're not always successful in farming. Farming is a challenge. You're at the whims of creation. And so they've tried to sort of mitigate and subsidize by putting up windmills everywhere, right? Do you know how much oil it takes to make one windmill? It's massive. I don't know that we can ever, well, we're going to have to at some point in humanity's history, unless Jesus comes back, figure out alternatives to fossil fuels. But right now, the ways in which we're moving, I'm not convinced are actually making us carbon neutral, whatever that means. Usually it means that I reduce carbon in certain areas, even though I have to use carbon. For example, electric cars, right? So here's the, you know, well, and I, you know, there were a number of eyes rolling. So here's the challenge, I think, for us, is not to simply dismiss it. And that's how we often respond, is we simply dismiss it. Because and these are questions that I know somebody's asking, but it hasn't filtered down to us peons, all right? So the question is not how do we quit using fossil fuels, but how do we use them better, right? So is it a better use of fossil fuels to build electric cars than cars that burn that gas and spew it into the air, right? And again, I'm not arguing either way. I'm just saying that's a question that we need to ask, and that's a question that needs to be researched so that we can actually say it is better for us or it's not better for us to have electric cars, right? Rather than just out of hand, dismissive, I don't like that regime, therefore it's bad, okay? That's just silliness. We need to ask the right questions. Or this one, gas prices are so high because the first thing that Joe Biden did when he came into office was to shut down a pipeline. No, he didn't shut down a pipeline. The pipeline wasn't working. There was nothing going through it. Right? He shut down the building of a pipeline. Now, whether or not that's I'm not sure or convinced that we should have shut it down. Okay, but what I'm saying is, don't argue that our gas prices went through the roof because he shut down a pipeline. Because that wasn't pumping anything, right? And anyway, gas prices, there are 1,000 things that have made gas prices go up. Some of which maybe the current administration has been responsible for, but I would argue also many of them, it would have happened regardless of who was sitting in the White House. It would have happened regardless. Because we also enjoyed depressed gas prices last summer because nobody was going anywhere. So when you go from $1.49 gas to $3.49 gas, that's pretty hard for us. Anyway, I'm preaching, sorry. Questions. We have a few minutes.
Lithium, the process they use it by, from what I've understood and from what I've seen, was the strip mine. They
correct.
They totally destroyed the environment in order to get to that lithium. So.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah.
Where oil pumping, they've got it down to a science where they're not doing that much damage to the environment.
Yeah, although.
Damage we can see.
Right, there's, right. And so we're fracking in Oklahoma. And just circumstantially, earthquakes start happening exponentially more than they ever happened before. So are we not, okay, so again, we have to balance those things and ask hard questions. I mean, I grew up in a coal mining community where when they stripped the mine, the coal, they just left it. They just left it. And then when they sorted the coal, there was what was called bony, which is just nasty sulfur rock. And so what did they do with that? They just piled it up high next to all these creeks and rivers and streams, and all of that leached into, so you never went fishing in those places, you never went swimming in those places, right? And so what they began to understand is that we can strip, but it means that we have to restore. And so the hill behind the house where I grew up was stripped, and you couldn't tell that now. It's a pristine pasture, meadow now. So again, I think there is a positive to those environmental concerns. It's just that I'm concerned with some of the rhetoric surrounding a lot of the current environmental views. Yeah, Randy.
I'd like to make an observation that Christians should be embracing. I mean, the only argument I need is that God's creation is the work of his hand. He's put us in dominion over it. God is holy. In this sense, his creation is holy. We as Christians, people who understand who God is, our place living in subject to the living God, this should be a no-brainer. The problem is that for so many people involved in the ecological movement, the rhetoric turns off Christians to what they probably should be naturally doing.
Correct.
Because it becomes associated with people who have basically a pagan view of the world. And we see that, and it's like, I don't want anything to do with those people because they're stupid. And they are. But even stupid people can like have
Yeah, a great point. Thank you. I mean, because as Christians, we tend to react by saying, well, if they're doing it, then I'm not, or I shouldn't, right? And that's, we just need to worry about our part of the world and not get so worked up over we get worked up over things that, you know, who knows? But let's worry about our slice of the world here, right? Living in Maine, they were, so you have to buy your bags, plastic bags there. We had, I called them tax bags. We had to put our trash in bags that we had to buy. You couldn't just put your trash out. You had. So then we moved from that community. That was in Portland itself. We moved to another community that had bins. And they would come and look in your trash cans, because you had a trash can and you had a recycle can, and you had to make sure that you put the right things in the right place. But I was always intrigued, because one trash truck would pull up to my house every week. It would pick the trash and dump it and drop it and move forward and pick up the recycle bin and dump it in the same place. And the reason they did that was because they didn't have anywhere to actually put the recycles. So it's a work in progress. I know that there are scientists who are working on ways that we can use recycled materials for lots of good things. I've seen some work. I just read a study about making road material out of recycled material. I mean, those, I think those are really neat things that I hope we can figure out. So, yes, Diane.
Well, coming from Central Illinois, the wind power is mm-hmm.
Yes.
Where do they end up?
In the trap. Yeah, absolutely in the landfill. Yeah.
So there needs to be questions.
There does. Yeah, well, and what are they made out of? Steel, which requires fossil fuels. So, yeah, again, to Randy's point, let's not be reactive. Let's do our part and make sure that we can,
And part of, I think, the responsibility is to investigate who you listen to. I mean, the U.S. Petroleum Institute may not be the best source to listen to for about oil situations, fossil fuels, just like the American Tobacco Institute, one place to listen about whether cigarettes cause cancer.
Correct.
but that's a function of this age that we live in.
It is.
You can look at the other side and you can see the politicization of science.
Right.
And so you can't trust a lot of what you were 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
You would have listened to the scientists because they might have been all over the map, but they were searching for the truth. Now they're searching for subsidies. And you look at, well, you talk about carbon credits. Well, look at who's making money from college credits. Bunch of left-wing politicians.
Correct.
I mean, so, you know, it's hard to find that truth. You're right, Andy, but knowing where to
start. Yeah. And there are a lot of scientists out there who are not convinced in that we are in a environmental crisis related to warming climate. But we live in an environment where those voices are silenced. They are absolutely silenced. And so it becomes very challenging. If you find it on the internet, that's probably not the place to be looking for our materials, right? There you go. Anyway, all right, I've extended my time. I hope I wasn't overbearing. I'm trying not to be overbearing. I may tackle Christian nationalism next week. We'll see.